This evening I'm going to be taking up the next three psalms. We're picking up the pace a little bit here this evening and looking at the next three psalms in this series of songs of ascents or songs of degrees. The first four that we've looked at thus far start us off and launch us on our journey. And now we're getting into the body of this collection. And we're going to look at it in several blocks, several different chunks together. Imagine for a moment a rectangle filled with color. And let's suppose that one side of the rectangle is red, and the other side is blue, and the color just gradually blends from red to blue across that rectangle. If we wanted to study that color in that rectangle, we could cut it right in half and spend some time studying the red side and spend some time studying the blue side. Or we could take that same rectangle and cut it into three pieces. And if we did that, we could study the red side, the purple center, and the blue side. And what I'm illustrating with this image is the fact that a section of psalms like this are a beautiful collection of songs, and we could divide it up in a number of different ways for the sake of our study here together. As it turns out, I have six sessions to spend with you working through the psalms, and so that has in many ways governed how I've broken up this set of songs of degrees. So we're looking at these next three songs under the heading Help for Doubters. And this is a heading that helps to bring out something that is a common theme through this block of psalms. But by doing this, I don't want you to suppose that this is the only way to examine and organize these psalms for our study. But we're going to look at these next three psalms under the heading Help for Doubters, Psalms 124, 125, and 126. These three psalms teach us the faithfulness of God to his people. And when the journey gets tough and you experience doubts in God's faithfulness along the way, these three psalms confront those doubts to strengthen our confidence in God's faithfulness. Even if you're not struggling with doubts, these psalms will serve to encourage even greater joy in God's faithfulness in your heart. Each of these psalms presents us with evidence to help us trust in God's faithfulness. There are proofs offered to us in these three psalms to encourage your trust in God's goodness. In a human court of law, when you present your case, you must bring evidence into the courtroom. Your word alone will not suffice in a human court of law. That's because humans are fallible, and humans often deceive or are deceived. And so in a human context, your word is not enough to build a case. You must bring evidence also. But that's not the case with respect to God. God is not a man that he should lie. His word, his promise alone is sufficient and is rock solid for us. When he speaks his promise, his word alone gives us confidence. He does not need to provide evidence. Nevertheless, he does so, as in these three psalms we're looking at this evening. In his mercy and in his desire to strengthen your weak faith, our Lord offers evidence to encourage you and to help you to trust his faithfulness in your own journey from the city of destruction to the celestial city. In Psalm 124, we have evidence from history. From Psalm 125, we have evidence from the land. And in Psalm 126, we have evidence from one profound event of God's deliverance. Let's trust the Spirit of God to help us to heed and to embrace these encouragements in God's faithfulness and to strengthen our praise in Him on our journey this evening. Psalm 124 is a psalm of remembering our history as God's people. Of course, it takes a lot more than just these few verses to review all of the history of God's care for His people. This is not an exhaustive review of history, but it is a summary, a synopsis of one specific pattern of history that this psalm helps us to recall. The first five verses of the 124th Psalm distill that one key lesson from our experience of God through history. And then verses 6 through 8 turn to a word of praise. The final three verses of the psalm lead us to respond to this evidence from history with a shout of praise to our faithful God. Part one of the psalm leads us to remember God's faithfulness distilled from history. Part two helps fill our hearts with praise in response to that lesson. But notice how this psalm of remembering begins. It's another psalm that begins with the voice of our chief catechizer urging and drawing us into his faith. If it had not been the Lord who was on our side, the lead psalm singer begins. And then he calls upon all of you. He says, let all of Israel say, may all Israel say now, join with me, may Israel say, if it had not been the Lord who was on our side. These are words of gentle but urgent coaxing. The lead voice of the psalm opens the lesson with a testimony of his own faith in the Father. And then he pauses to urge all of Israel, all of you, his people, to join this song and to own this as your conviction also. All of the psalms are led by the Davidic air, as we have said time and time again. But this is another one of those psalms that is specifically ascribed in its header to the Davidic, to David's own pen. And today it is the Son of David who begins his own testimony of faith and calls us to join him in this exercise that brings our hearts into harmony with his faith. If it had not been the Lord who was on our side, now may Israel say, if it had not been the Lord who was on our side. So what is the historical event that the psalm is leading us to remember in these opening five verses? When was it that Israel nearly perished as here described and was nearly washed away as in a flash flood? When was it that the Lord came to the aid of our spiritual forefathers, sparing them from near destruction? Well, here's the elegance of this concise little psalm. This is not a psalm about any one specific event. This little psalm helps us to distill a powerful lesson as we reflect on numerous events and patterns over the centuries of God's care for his people. The heritage of Adam was almost snuffed out by the powerful violence of Cain against Abel. The heritage of Noah was nearly extinguished by the rising corruption of his world. The patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, wandered as vulnerable sojourners under the shadow of mighty Canaanite kingdoms. Egypt sought to crush Israel in slavery. Assyria and Babylon sought to destroy Israel in war. Rome and the Sanhedrin conspired together to crucify your king. And the Roman Empire, like a mighty beast, sought to destroy the church. Even today, tyrants, terrorists, and secularists wield their power to erase the worship of the Lord from the face of the earth. This is not a single event being remembered in the psalm, but a common theme repeated over and over in history. This tiny psalm distills a massive lesson from all our experiences as God's people. And there are two sides to this lesson. On the one hand, this psalm reminds us from our history that the church is typically weak. I don't know about here in this part of the world, but in America, there is far too much of a longing in Christian circles to try to turn the church into an institutional force to transform politics and society. Yes, the church is to have great influence in the world, but the power of the church is not in her institutions or in her strategies. The power of the church is in the weakness of preaching the gospel. That is our power, the proclamation of the gospel, the weakness of preaching, as Paul put it. Apart from the power of the word, throughout history, God has typically called his people to walk in weakness and humility in the world, that the strength might not be in us, but only in him. God chose Jacob and not Esau. Jacob was the lesser of the two. Esau was the mighty hunter. God chose David, not his six older warrior brothers. David was the youngest and a mere shepherd boy when he was called. When Gideon successfully rallied a mighty army to fight the Midianites, God compelled him to downsize before the battle. If there's one thing the evidence of history teaches us about ourselves, the church, the people of God, it is our weakness. But the other side of this lesson is the faithfulness of God to his people. He is our power. God is faithful to his covenant promises. It is he who cast out Cain and raised up Seth. It is he who delivered Noah and judged the world. It is he who gave weak David success over mighty Goliath and all his enemies. And it is he who gave us a Messiah in human weakness and vulnerability, but raised him up to an eternal throne of sovereign authority. The lesson we learn from history is that the church is typically weak, and yet she is mightily preserved by God's faithfulness. Think about this history as recorded for us in the scriptures. What has happened to mighty Assyria that cast its shadow over Israel in times of old, and the worship of Asher, the god of Assyria? Where today is Marduk and Shamash and the other gods of ancient Babylon, so great and so fearsome before Israel? Who today offers tribute to Amun-Ra and Tot and the other deities of the mighty pharaohs of old? Today, the temples of Apollo and Zeus and Diana are in ruins. Think about the amazing evidence of God's faithfulness set before us. These mighty kingdoms and their gods that oppressed and overshadowed the peoples of Israel in their weakness are gone, forgotten, lost. Why is the faith of weak and tiny Judah, though constantly overshadowed and oppressed by the other powers of the world, why has the faith of Israel not only survived, but spread and flourished, so that even here in Malaysia, we are gathered from various nations of the world in love and worship for the God of Israel? You see, the conviction we distill from history in this little psalm is a powerful piece of real, solid, historical evidence to strengthen your hope, even in the face of doubts. For the actual events of history behind this meditation, turn back to the books like Genesis and Exodus and Numbers and Judges and Samuel and Acts and so forth. This psalm does not recall the specific events of our history, But it distills all that history into this one key lesson that we learn from it. God has not given his people over, but he has been faithful to us in all the ages. If he had not been so, we would be gone. We would be wiped away as in a flash flood, for the strength is not in ourselves, but he is faithful. Our help is in the name of the Lord who made heaven and earth. That confession in verse 8 at the end of this psalm is the ultimate conclusion from this psalm's meditation on the evidence of history. In spite of the persistent weakness of God's people throughout history, the household of God is still here and growing. The first half of the psalm stirs up our memory. The second half of the psalm helps to align our hearts to praise in response to this lesson. When you consider the amazing faithfulness of God to deliver his people time after time after time in all the history recorded in the Bible and beyond, you cannot help but be stirred to praise. Verses 6 through 8 lead us in praise in response to this testimony from history. That word blessed or blessed there in verse 6 marks the beginning of this outburst of praise. Blessed be the Lord, who hath not given us as a prey to their teeth. Our soul is escaped as a bird out of the snare of the fowlers. The snare is broken, and we are escaped. Our help is in the name of the Lord, who made heaven and earth. On Sunday, I spoke about one Hebrew word for a blessing, or translated as blessed in English, the word asher, which simply means happy and joyful. But this is the other Hebrew word that I mentioned, baruch, which is also typically translated in English as blessed. This is not the word that simply means happy. This is the word that describes favor. Favor bestowed from one who is great, bestowing his grace upon one who is needy. It's a term of God's favor upon us, who blesses us. And the same word also expresses our response in praise as the needy one in response to that favor. Many years ago, I used to be involved in ministry in Moscow, Russia. And I learned along the way that the Russian word for please, when you're asking for something, is pronounced pozhaluysta. Any of you speak Russian? I'm sorry if I'm not getting it quite right. But it's a term, pozhaluysta, which means please when you're making a request. But in Russian, then that exact same word is used to say thank you after that request is granted. Pozhaluysta. The word means please help me, and then it also means I am pleased that you have helped me. In a similar way, this Hebrew word baruch for bless is that is used in verse 6 is the word that means the favor of a great person bestowed upon a needy person. And then the exact same word is also used to express the gratitude and the praise of the one who has been shown that favor. And that's how the term is used here in verse 6. We bless God. We extol him because we are blessed by him. He has shown us favor, and so we acknowledge it as the favored ones with a shout of praise. Blessed be the Lord. Like so many psalms, this one uses vivid metaphors to grip our hearts and to help draw us into this praise. Verses 3 and 4 in the first half of the psalm invoked the imagery of a flash flood. In biblical Palestine, many of the rivers dried up during the hot summer months, and the ground would harden. And then when the rainy season began with a sudden downpour, the dry waterbeds filled and overflowed, and flash floods could be quite dangerous. The psalm uses that vivid imagery to stir our sense of the near flooding away of God's people in so many of their persecutions, yet God was faithful. Verses 6 through 8 then introduce the imagery of a bird hunter, a fowler, who sets a snare in order to catch a bird to eat it. Notably, this psalm envisions the trapper's initial success. The bird is caught in the snare. It appears at first that the bird is destined for the teeth of its captor. It is that close to being devoured. But then suddenly, the snare is shattered by someone else. It's not the bird that wriggles its way free. Somehow the snare is cracked open by another, and the bird in the last minute is set loose. The image is filled with that tension and that joy of sudden, marvelous release. The image is one that would be familiar to many Hebrews. And the purpose of imagery like this is not to make the psalm confusing or obscure. Quite the opposite. The purpose is to very simply and vividly engage both your head and your heart in the vivid sense of escape in order to help arouse the spirit of praise and joy in your heart. These images are here to help make the message of the psalm more visceral, so that when you sing the psalm, your heart is being filled and retrained from doubt to an experience of praise. Here's how Martin Luther describes this psalm. Luther writes, "Here is a necessary conclusion for the psalm. Our help is in the name of the Lord." It is a short sentence, Luther writes, but it setteth forth most worthy doctrine and consolation, whereof especially in these days, here Luther speaking of his own day, we have great need, seeing the Pope, together with the greatest part of the princes and rulers of the world, so cruelly do persecute the doctrine of the gospel. In respect to these huge mountains, what are we small molehills? And yet, this experience we have of the great mercy and goodness of the Lord our God, that we are safe through our confidence and trust in his help. I want you to notice something in that quote from Luther. You see, Luther is not simply explaining the meaning of this psalm. He's not just admiring this psalm like an artifact sitting in a glass case to be talked about. Luther's taking this psalm out and using it as a tool to help him measure his own circumstances, his own trials, and the droughts and struggles of his own day. Martin Luther felt, as he describes in that quotation, in his day, like a molehill facing off against the mountains of the Pope in Rome and the various princes and rulers of Europe. But this psalm gave Luther the evidence of God's work and faithfulness on behalf of his weak and oppressed people all through history, delivering them in his grace and favor time after time. Reflecting on that evidence of God's faithfulness in this psalm, Luther found joy to praise God in the face of his own trials. That's the blessing we too receive from Psalm 124. If it had not been the Lord who was on our side, the faith of weak and tiny Israel would have gone the way of the peoples of Assyria and Hatti and Edom and the other ancient peoples of the world. But our forefathers, weak and oppressed though they were, always had a remnant, and God always delivered and raised them up again. The fact that we, Gentiles of all stripes, are worshiping the God of Israel today is part of the evidence tangibly set before us in this psalm. Your God is demonstrably faithful. Let's turn our attention next to the evidence provided for your further praise in Psalm 125. The second psalm in our block of help for doubters turns to a very different kind of evidence. Psalm 125 reinforces our hope with a second line of evidence, looking at the architecture, the terrain of Mount Zion itself. When my wife and I began looking for a home in the community where I was called to pastor, we had a list of features we were looking for in a house. And we had those certain features in mind because of the patterns of life of our family. We home educate our youngest children, and so we wanted a home with a space we could use for homeschooling. I also wanted space for my study as a minister. Our congregation does not own a building, and so my study would need to be in our home. And there were other aspects of our pattern of life as a family that dictated the features we were hoping to find in a house. And in God's kindness, we found a home that has been serving us beautifully. What I want to illustrate is this. A building's structure, the architecture and layout of the facility, reflects the purposes of the one who chose it. Psalm 125 applies that idea to the architecture, if you will, of the mountain where God established his temple and the capital of his Old Testament kingdom. This psalm provides us with a geographical or architectural piece of evidence to further show you the good purposes of God to love and guard and nurture and care for his people. The evidence in this psalm is presented in verses 1 and 2. And then its interpretation for our faith follows in verses 3 through 5. The evidence is set before us in the first two verses, and it's the physical arrangement of Mount Zion, which God had chosen for his people. Now, the Judean hill country is pretty rugged terrain. Today, roads and cars make it easy to get around. But in times when travel was done by foot, the Judean hill country was tough. There are sharp up and down V-shaped hills and valleys carved through the heartland of Canaan. Mount Zion was a strategically choice location right in the middle of that rugged terrain. First of all, it was located roughly in the center of Israel, making it a central location from which to rule and toward which pilgrims could make their journeys. Secondly, Mount Zion is a hill located along a watershed ridgeline running north and south right through the heart of Israel. That means as difficult as it was to travel across Judean valleys, Zion was along a ridgeline, making a natural highway through the land north and south, allowing it to be a site to communicate with the rest of the land. Likewise, there's a valley system running east and west from Zion, giving it natural routes to the east and west of the land as well. But most significantly, on top of its central location and its ready access with the rest of the country, Zion also has a remarkable defensive arrangement, which is the reality pondered in this psalm. When I was studying in Jerusalem years ago, my professor used to say, Mount Zion is like a bump in the bottom of a bowl. That's a good way to picture it. None of the mountains in Judah are high mountains like the American Rocky Mountains. The mountains of Judah are what we might alternately call big hills. Zion itself rises about 250 or 300 feet above the valleys around it. I'm not good with my metrics, so someone out there, you can do the math to convert that into meters. But it's about 250 or 300 feet above the valleys around it. But on all sides of Zion, there are mountains even taller than Zion, like walls around her. The Mount of Olives to the east of Mount Zion stands 200 feet taller than Zion. To the northeast Mount Scopus stands 250 feet taller. A range of mountains to the west of Zion stands about 100 feet taller. And to the south is a rise 175 feet taller than Zion. All these factors made Mount Zion the ideal capital city for Israel. It was readily accessible to govern the land and to welcome pilgrims for worship, but it was also naturally well defended from enemy invasions. Man-made walls around a city are great, but this was a city with man-made walls and with God-made walls, mountains, around that. This physical reality is cited in Psalm 125 as another piece of evidence concerning God's purpose for his people and his intentions to protect and to care for them. This is a city which cannot be moved but abides forever, like the mountains around Zion. But notice that it's not Zion itself that is the focus of our trust. It's a word picture. It's an image that shows us the purpose of God. It's important to remember that it is God and his care that is the focus in this text. If someday, God forbid, an enemy of modern Israel managed to drop a nuclear bomb and erase Mount Zion from the map, that would not undermine the truth of this psalm. The point of that phrase, Mount Zion cannot be moved but abides forever, captures the vast superiority of mountains as the best example available in the psalmist's day over man-made walls to illustrate what is truly permanent and unmovable: the abiding love of God for his people. And the Old Testament singers of the psalm understood this point. You see, David himself had once conquered the Jebusite city, which was located on Mount Zion. The mountain was not utterly unassailable when God was on the side of Israel in their fighting against it. But a mountain-fortified city is about as powerful an image of impregnability as you can get. The virtual inviolability of Mount Zion is evidence for the absolute inviolability of God's love for his people. It's not, after all, Mount Zion in which we place our faith. Just as a parent's choice of a house for a family reveals something about the parent's care for the family, so the Lord's choice of Zion reveals the purpose of God to care for his people, which is what this psalm wants us to recognize. Calvin writes, "The author of the psalm shows, under the figure of mountains, the secret protection with which God defends his own people to this end, that the ignorant and feeble-minded, who are still held down to the earth by their own dullness of understanding," he's talking about all of us in our weakness, "aided by the sight of the mountains, may raise their minds upward to the contemplation of heavenly things." The mountains are a pointer. Our confidence is in the Lord. I make this distinction for a particular reason that comes to light as we now move into the second half of this psalm, the interpretation of this imagery from the mountain in verses 3 through 5. Verses 3 through 5 read, "For the rod of the wicked shall not rest upon the lot of the righteous, lest the righteous put forth their hands unto iniquity. Do good, O Lord, is the cry, unto those that be good, and to them that are upright in their hearts. As for such as turn aside unto their crooked ways, the Lord shall lead them forth with the workers of iniquity. But peace shall be upon Israel." You see, this is a psalm that raises its cry in a time when the rod of the wicked is upon the righteous and oppressing them. But the promise here is that the rod of the wicked shall not rest or shall not remain upon the righteous. It is hope in the Lord that the psalm itself leads us to draw from the sight of the mountains. Joachim Krauss points out the word "for" at the beginning of verse 3 introduces a promise or prophetic announcement of salvation. Verses 3 through 5 are the interpretation of the evidence considered in verses 1 through 2. And here is what we deduce from the structure of God's city. Even when we are under a wicked scepter and oppressed, God will yet raise up a new king with a righteous scepter to reign over us. That's the testimony of the geography of the land he appointed. You see, this psalm arises in a time when Mount Zion had been overrun. Many scholars believe this psalm, along with the next psalm we're going to look at, 126, belong to the post-exilic period, after a remnant of Jews returned to Jerusalem with Ezra and Nehemiah, but were still laboring under the rule of Persia, drawing many away after their iniquities, and waiting for Messiah to come and to deliver them. This conclusion arises from verse 3, which describes the scepter of the wicked as the present reality, but one which will not remain. The verb translated "rest" in verse 3 indicates the wicked scepter is here, but cannot remain here with such a protecting God who cares for his people. Commentator Craig Broyles explains, "The psalm appears to stem from the period after the Hebrews returned to their homeland under the government of the Persian Empire. The people are present in the land allotted to the righteous, but are under the scepter or control of the wicked." Mount Zion was not itself utterly inviolable, but its structure teaches us about God's heart and purpose to faithfully protect his people. And he is inviolable. He is almighty and sovereign. Nothing happens apart from his approval, and he will always deliver his people. Therefore, the psalm singer living in that time looked out at the mountains surrounding Jerusalem and saw in the real estate itself a tangible demonstration of God's purpose to guard and deliver his people. The land itself offered encouragement, even in a time of oppression, to wait upon the Lord to deliver the present from the present scepter of wickedness. But notice how the removal of that scepter is described in these verses. When God brings the overthrow of Israel's oppressor, it will not be based on ethnicity that God saves some and condemns others. Verse 4 tells us that it is those whose hearts are made right with God, who are made and accounted as good in his sight, who receive his good. While verse 5 tells us that those who abandon the Lord to follow the iniquitous idols of the oppressing world will share in the world's judgment. In short, it is by faith that we are saved, not by being a Jew versus being a Gentile. There's a word of special encouragement here in this psalm for you and I who are not native sons and daughters of Abraham. But if you have made your heart right with God through faith in the sacrifice he has provided and have been made good in his sight by his atonement, then you are like Mount Zion, surrounded by the God-made walls of his faithful love. Finally, before we turn to the third psalm in this block, I want you to see that this too is another psalm about Christ. What is the scepter that is supposed to reign over the people of God? Implicit in the anticipated end of the wicked scepter from reigning over God's people is the anticipation of the rise of the righteous scepter. Augustine makes this point nicely in his comments. A time will come when Christ, appearing in his glory, shall gather all nations before him. For as long as the good serve under evil masters, let them endure for a season. He gives us this promise in verse 3, that the righteous may endure for a season the dominion of the ungodly, and may understand that this is not forever, but may prepare themselves to possess their everlasting heritage. Our hope is in the Lord, whose anointed king will overthrow all scepters of the wicked that overshadow and mock the church. The very architecture of the land around Mount Zion is a tangible demonstration, another piece of evidence of the protective love of God for his people. Psalm 125 is an elaborate little psalm that helps us weigh the evidence of Zion's geography and what it demonstrates for us about the heart of the God who began his kingdom from that location. Finally, then, tonight, we have Psalm 126, which introduces a third witness to strengthen our faith, even in the face of doubting. This third psalm in our evidence set takes us to a specific event in history. The year was 539 BC. And in that year, the sun broke over the horizon after the darkest night in Old Testament history. Without question, the closest Israel came to total extinction in the Old Testament history was after Babylon invaded and razed the temple to the ground and hauled off Judah's children into captivity to train them in the ways of Babylon. In the British Museum in London, there's an exhibit that if you ever visit, you really ought to take time to see. Archaeologists have uncovered an entire intact set of wall reliefs from the Assyrian palace of Sennacherib from Nineveh. And the reliefs that I'm thinking of are some of those from that palace, which depict in a long 20 or 30 foot long display the siege of Sennacherib against the Hebrew city of Lachish. And the imagery, using just stone and chisels, is as gripping as anything a modern movie might try to create. It displays the force of armies laying siege, the fear on the faces of the city inhabitants as enemy stormtroopers lay ladders against the walls, and the pathetic horror of women and children led into slavery as men are slaughtered before their eyes. All these images and more are graphically captured in the days when these things were happening in those reliefs. And they give us a profound picture into the nature of Old Testament siege warfare and its devastating aftermath. War is horrible. But when Babylon laid such siege upon Jerusalem, it was more than an emotional and physical devastation. It was a crisis of faith, unlike anything Israel had ever faced, at least since Egypt. But the blackness of the Babylonian destruction only serves to magnify the beauty of this moment captured in Psalm 126, when God moved in the heart of the Persian king Cyrus to permit a remnant of the Jews to return and rebuild Jerusalem. The significance of that restoration cannot be overstated. It demonstrated, again with hard evidence, that God had not given up on his promises with Israel. His promises would continue and even expand further. It's that profound evidence of God's faithfulness, can I even say, God's stubborn faithfulness to his promises, not only to continue, but as we see in this psalm, to marvelously expand his purposes, that this third psalm gives us evidence to encourage our faith in that work. The first three verses of this psalm measure the true greatness of this event. And then the final three verses anticipate the future implications of this marvelous event. I love these opening lines of this psalm. When the Lord turned again the captivity of Zion, we were like them that dream. Then was our mouth filled with laughter, and our tongue with singing. Then said they among the heathen, the Lord hath done great things for them. Here's a poem composed in a society very, very different from our own. Yet these are people whose way of life, though worlds apart from our own, nonetheless, in these Hebrew worshipers, we see joy that we can identify with so vividly. They too know the disappointment of dreams unfulfilled, and they too experience that unparalleled surge of joy when the seemingly impossible actually occurs. The joy and laughter of these lines are a universal language, and these laughs declare God is faithful and good. He turns our bitter sorrows into the bright light of morning. Hallelujah, praise to his name. But notice the pair of then statements in verse 2. You see, there are two choirs of praise marveling here. Look at the marvel of what God is doing. First of all, our tongue was raised in singing. We sing with these returning captives. The returnees sang with joy at what God had done to show his faithfulness. But secondly, verse 2 continues, then said they among the heathen, or a better translation, they among the nations, the Lord hath done great things for them, for Israel. This is not quite yet a confession of faith among the Gentiles, but it's a foretaste of that fruit, the testimony that is now going forth among the Gentiles in what God is doing for his people. It's that foretaste of the fruit of faith beginning to blossom among the nations. You see, God was doing something far greater than just restoring Jerusalem. God doesn't stall in his program and his purposes. He not only restores Jerusalem, but he is moving his purposes forward. And that is why we call these great things. God's putting the evidence of his goodness on display before the whole world. The returnees rejoice, and out among the nations, voices join in praise of God there also. Martin Luther, to quote him again, writes, these things do make for our comfort, which are not of the seed of Abraham after the flesh. For although the promise of God was not made unto us at the first, we Gentiles were made partakers thereof, according to the promise to Abraham, in thy seed shall all nations be blessed. Thus do we Gentiles pertain to this laughter and this joy, preach not only in Zion, but amongst the Gentiles, which do enjoy all the good blessings of God together with them. Even though there was only a small remnant of one tribe of Israel restored in that event, the mercy demonstrated in that tiny remnant was a word of hope for all the nations. This is remarkable evidence of God's faithfulness. And it's evidence that gives us foundations to hope for more. Verse 4 turns our voice to petition and expectation in the final part of this psalm. Turn again our captivity, O Lord, as the streams in the south. They that sow in tears shall reap in joy. He that goeth forth and weepeth, bearing precious seed, shall doubtless come again with rejoicing, bringing his sheaves with him. It's a plea, but a plea raised in expectation and confidence, because of what we know of the Lord's goodness. Notice how back in verse 1 we spoke of the Lord having already turned again the captivity of Zion. But now notice how verse 5 cries out, or verse 4 cries out for God to yet in the future turn yet again more our captivity. The return of the remnant of Israel in 539 BC was just the beginning. Many more, including from among those Gentiles joining in this psalm, are yet to be turned from captivity to praise. One commentator writes, "To be sure, certain groups had returned from the exile, but where was the worldwide appearance of the glory of Yahweh, the encounter with the nations, and the transformation of the world the prophets had foretold? Only a beginning of his promised work had been made." According to Ezra, about 50,000 people returned to Jerusalem from the Babylonian exile, primarily from two tribes. This was not yet the global salvation the scriptures had promised, but it was a powerful testimony, a down payment, evidence that enlivens our hope in the faithfulness of God for yet more. The opening half of the psalm leads us in confession of faith that God does save, as evidenced by his mercy in the return of the Babylonian exile. But the closing half of this psalm is a petition that he would continue to save even more from captivity people like us, and bring us also through the wilderness, like those returnees from Babylon, to Jerusalem, the house of God. The psalm closes with a number of nature metaphors that capture the theme of resurrection. First, in verse 4, our eyes are turned to the streams of the south in the desert. The desert where the streams dry up in the summer, as I described earlier. But when the rainy season in the hills begins, the dry riverbeds in the desert plains flood with water, ultimately bringing life even to the dry desert. It's the nature of God to be one of resurrection life. Second, our eyes are turned to the sowing and reaping of agriculture. If we are going to live and to labor in harmony with God's ways, we're going to have to expect to toil with tears now. But because we know our God is faithful in his promises, we do so in anticipation of harvest. The dead ground, so painful to break up for sowing, that draws tears, produces new life in the harvest season. Notice how both of these images of resurrection, of new life, the return of water to the deserts, and the return of a new season of crops to the fields, these images of new life capture the joy of captives delivered and brought to God's house to dwell with him. The joy that undergirds this psalm from verses 1 through 6 is the joy of being restored into fellowship with the Lord, the faithful one. God is faithful. We have evidence of his faithfulness to deliver and preserve his people through history, Psalm 124. We have evidence of his faithfulness, even in Mount Zion, the physical location of this mountain, chosen to tangibly display his protective love in Psalm 125. And we have the testimony of the return from captivity and our hope for more to be turned to the Lord as we sing in Psalm 126. Of course, there's so much more evidence that could be offered to demonstrate the goodness of God. Today, in particular, we have the resurrection of Christ as the greatest evidence of all of God's faithfulness. These psalms are not attempting to provide a comprehensive survey of these proofs. They're short psalms, but each in its profound simplicity touches a theme of God's goodness as tangibly demonstrated. And in these psalms, Jesus, your song leader, confronts your weak faith and your doubts to help stir up your praise in God's faithfulness, to encourage you and strengthen you on our journey as a returning remnant through the wilderness to God's house. Let's stand and pray together for encouragement in this faith, and then we'll close in singing Psalm 126. Let's pray. Our Lord, we thank you for the beauty of these psalms and for the encouragement they are to our hearts. Most of all, we thank you for your love that is communicated by them. Lord, they're not just beautiful pieces of poetry to admire, but they are a testimony of a God of grace, of mercy, of resurrection hope, and of love. Heavenly Father, I pray that you would be pleased to use these psalms, even as we sing them together this week, to strengthen our hope in your faithfulness for our journey as we wait upon you. Amen. Let's sing together Psalm 126.